the best 10 shows of 2011. This week, we hear excerpts from interviews with authors Tamima Anam, Teju Cole, James Kaplan, Susan Rosenberg, and Carl Safina. We also tell you about 5 other show episodes that made the list. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Every year, I have the same dilemma. Which 10 shows should I pick for the annual best of list? It's rough, because I can easily come up with 10 different shows. There are so many great authors who grace our airwaves on Writer's Voice. It's tough enough just picking them, and I refuse to rank them, so we'll go in alphabetical order. First up is Tamima Anam. Her latest novel, The Good Muslim, continues the story she began in her first book, A Golden Age. Tamima Anam's first novel, A Golden Age, told the story of the widow Rehana Haque and her 2 teenage children as they become involved in Bangladesh's struggle for independence. The Liberation War was an armed conflict that pitted East Pakistan and India against West Pakistan. The war ended in the secession of East Pakistan, which became the independent nation of Bangladesh. It was a brutal conflict, with many of the features that have become typical of modern civil war, including mass rape and the targeting of civilians. The fight was about more than political independence. It was also about democracy versus dictatorship, language, and religion. Anam's first book showed how becoming active in the struggle changed the widow Rehana Haque. Now, in her new novel, The Good Muslim, she explores what happened to Rehana's children, Maya and Sohail, how the War of Independence changed them, and how they each deal so differently with the trauma of war that has been seared into their souls. Tamima Anam, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
The first time we spoke with you, we spoke to you about your debut novel, The Golden Age, and in it you tell the story of a widow with 2 teenage children and how the family becomes involved in Bangladesh's struggle for independence. When we talked to you about that in 2008, you told us you wanted to see how war changed people, and you focused very much on the widow, Rehana Haque. Now in this new novel, The Good Muslim, the story begins 7 years after independence has been won, and it puts a focus more on the adult children, Maya and Sohail. Let's start with Maya. Tell us about her.
Well, Maya is kind of inspired by a lot of people I met in Bangladesh who were young women when the war broke out. And as many women in war, they were allowed to do things because it was that sort of situation that they would never have been allowed to do otherwise. So, you know, Maya in the war, she drives an ambulance, she works in a refugee camp, she joins a political movement, and she calls other people comrade. So it's a kind of moment of liberation for her. And as a result, when the war is over, she really takes her fate into her own hands, and she decides she's going to sort of abandon convention. She's not going to marry, and she's going to be a doctor. And so she goes into the villages, she leaves home, and she's basically a sort of charismatic, progressive, and she's a feminist as well. That's a, you know, she's very politically self-conscious.
And she's marked by the war.
Absolutely. She and her brother both, although they're very young, and because they're very young when the war breaks out, they're so influenced by that. And she has all these memories of these traumatic things that she has seen. So she comes out of the war, and the way she copes with it is by throwing herself into the service of her country. And her brother, also coping with this trauma of war, with things he's seen, and also because he's a soldier, with things he's done, he clings to his faith. He needs a moral scaffolding, and he chooses his faith.
Now, when the novel starts out, The Good Muslim, Maya is just coming home after 7 years away. Tell us where she's been and what she's been doing.
Well, Maya leaves home because she's really upset when, after the war, her brother turns to religion. And it's sort of difficult to imagine why someone would leave home on that account, but she's so afraid of what religion can do to people because the war that she's just fought was fought kind of on the basis of this, you know, this contest over what it means to be Muslim, which is, you know, when Bangladesh, what used to be East Pakistan, when it became independent, that war had a lot to do with these kinds of issues of identity. So she's really upset when her brother turns to religion, and she leaves home, and she becomes a doctor, and she calls herself a lady doctor. And to her, that means she goes to very remote areas where women don't have access to healthcare, and she treats them, and mostly she helps children come into the world safely.
But she wasn't always helping children come into the world. Do you want to talk a little bit about the, and this is something that, that really happened during the war, the rapes, the mass rapes of women?
Yes, so Maya, after the war is over, people discovered that in fact the Pakistan army had conducted a campaign of sexual violence against Bangladeshi civilians. Oftentimes they would kidnap women from their homes and had kept them as basically as, you know, prisoner for the whole 9 months of the war. And when these women are released, when the war is over, many of them are pregnant. And there's a kind of national mood, you know, spurred by the prime minister, the leader of the independence movement, Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, and he says, we must embrace these women. But he doesn't want to embrace their children because they are the product of rape. So there are a lot. There's a lot of pressure for these women to abort their babies. And Maya, she comes out of the war, and she wants to serve her country. And she's told that in fact she's doing something for the greater good, and she helps, assists in a lot of these abortions. But over time, she starts to feel incredibly guilty about these. So as she gets older, part of her crusade or campaign for helping babies come into the world safely, you know, she says it's like one baby that's coming into the world, almost to put on a scale against a baby that she might have helped to abort just after the war.
A lot of the book, The New Muslim, is about how people process the trauma that they've gone through. You've talked about how Maya is doing it. Tell us how Sohail, I mean, already we know that he has turned religious. What was he like before? What kind of a change is this for him? And why has he turned to religion?
I suppose one of the questions that the good Muslim tries to answer is, how do people become extremists? And I wanted to give Sohail a real reason for turning to his faith. Now, he takes it too far, but at first he turns to his faith because he's really lost, and before the war, he's this really attractive revolutionary, and he has a very romantic sense of himself. And when the war is over, he's kind of lost that sense of himself, and he is sort of addicted to that idea that he's going to throw himself into a movement or having an identity that's to do with more than just his individual life. And so he's kind of defeated by the ordinariness of life as a citizen, and he wants something more. So he turns to his faith, first because it gives him a way to make sense of the world, but then it also really fits in with his character, which is that he needs some kind of, you know, some kind of movement or some kind of idea to throw himself into. And it becomes, that's why he takes it as far as he does.
And therein lies the conflict between him and his sister. I love how in this book, The Good Muslim, well, I think there are some sides you take. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that you're not an advocate of fundamentalist extremism. It's a very nuanced book. There's great ambivalence and humanity to the characters in spite of their flaws. Could you talk a little bit about the dynamic that goes on between Maya and Sohail?
Well, you know, part of the reason I wrote this book and gave this particular title is that there are contestations and debates within Muslim communities about what it means to be a Muslim. It's not just a conversation that people from the outside are having with these communities. So there's a wide variety of religious practice in any Muslim society, and especially in a place like Bangladesh, where for the most part people are very devout, but they have never wanted Islam to be part of their political identity. And extremism is very marginalized. So, you know, Maya is a person that you would meet in Bangladesh, an avid secularist. She doesn't really relate to the Islamic side of her identity. And then there's Sohail, for whom it takes over everything. But also there's the character of the mother, and she's kind of balancing between the two because for her, Islam is a big part of her identity. She practices, you know, she prays every day, but it's not the only identity. And she's a little bit older, and she's lived a long and complicated life, so she can really have a balanced sense of herself, whereas maybe her children in this fiery, youthful, post-revolutionary passion feel that they either have to fully embrace or fully reject this idea of faith.
Tamima Anam. You can hear the full interview with Anam about both her books, The Good Muslim and A Golden Age, at writersvoice.net. Next, we hear our interview with Teju Cole, which first aired on the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. Cole's celebrated novel, Open City, takes place in a New York City marked by the events of that day. Its narrator and protagonist, Julius, is a young Nigerian-German immigrant doing his residency as a psychiatrist at a New York City hospital. The interplay between outsider and insider, between trauma and consequence, and human connections acknowledged and denied, are explored in this powerful and evocative novel, Open City. Now, you were born in Michigan, but you were raised in Nigeria, like your character, and live in New York, again, like him. It seemed to me in reading this book, Open City, that it was a story of a man who was a bit of a stranger, a man who was an observer. I wondered if that was something that you had taken on to explore just in this book, or is this something that you yourself have experienced?
I think both of those things are true. The book is not an autobiography, but sometimes when you want to write a novel, you're containing a story between the two flaps of the covers. I feel like the best way to do that is to just take a part of reality and to explore it intensely. So like many other people who have sort of immigrated to the U.S., I have certainly experienced isolation or loneliness or even alienation. But I wanted to explore those topics in perhaps in a deeper way than has been my own experience. I'm actually fairly comfortably integrated into my life here. Julius is very different from me in this way. He doesn't have many friends, and he's quite distant from his family. But I needed to write that character that way in order to explore those things. So it's my story, but it's not my story at all.
He reminded me in some ways of Walter Benjamin's Flaneur, certainly in the beginning part of the book. He begins to take long walks in the city. He's a psychiatric resident. The language was really wonderful that this book was written in, and I just wonder if you'd be willing to read a short passage that just kind of introduces us to both the language as well as a bit of his unique perspective.
Sure. At first, I encountered the streets as an incessant loudness, a shock after the day's focus and relative tranquility, as though someone had shattered the calm of a silent private chapel with the blare of a TV set. I wove my way through crowds of shoppers and workers, through road constructions and the horns of taxicabs. Walking through the busy parts of town meant I laid eyes on more people, hundreds more, thousands even, than I was accustomed to seeing in the course of a day. But the impress of these countless faces did nothing to assuage my feelings of isolation. If anything, it intensified them. I became more tired too after the walks began, an exhaustion unlike any I had known since the first months of internship 3 years earlier. One night, I simply went on and on, walking all the way down to Houston Street, a distance of some 7 miles, and found myself in a state of disorienting fatigue, laboring to remain on my feet. That night, I took the subway home, and instead of falling asleep immediately, I lay in bed, too tired to release myself from wakefulness. And I rehearsed in the dark the numerous incidents and sights I had encountered while roaming, sorting each encounter like a child playing with wooden blocks, trying to figure out which belonged where, which responded to which. Each neighborhood of the city appeared to be made of a different substance. Each seemed to have a different air pressure, a different psychic weight. The bright lights and shuttered shops, the housing projects and luxury hotels, the fire escapes and city parks. My futile task of sorting went on until the forms began to morph into each other and assume abstract shapes unrelated to the real city. And only then did my hectic mind finally show some pity and still itself. Only then did dreamless sleep arrive.
Now, what is he sorting? He's just coming off from a relationship that is, if not ended, is ending. But one has a sense that he's really sorting out a whole lot more.
What interested me was the connection between the self and the society, the microcosmic personal experience, and how that relates to the macrocosm of what it even means to be out in this world where others are as well. So what he's sorting, explicitly what he's sorting, is human historical experience as it is lived within the city. So he's going to places and he's seeing something of their history, something of the trace of the past in those places. But what implicitly is being solved is his own part in that. I mean, maybe the struggle of the book is to come some kind of solution and not quite getting there, saying that this is not something you can neatly tie a bow around. So Julius is somebody in his life who is mourning various losses within the context of a society that is mourning or failing to mourn any number of losses and historical atrocities.
There's a kind of ambiguous part in the book that comes toward the end where he is confronted by somebody who knew him when he was a teenager, who makes a pretty drastic accusation of him. The sense that the reader gets is that you don't really know if this has actually happened. Is this something that he just doesn't remember, that he's hiding to himself, or even that he does remember but won't admit?
The question for me was, when you're dealing with somebody who has access to words in terms of being able to articulate his experience of the world, and who has access to thought in a layered and intricate way, how does such a person deal with something they don't want to deal with? And in this book, you know, part of what Julius is doing, certainly that incident, even though it comes as a bit as a surprise, it is foreshadowed with other things that he has sort of, on a very minor level, ignored or neglected, such as the fact, for example, that he just doesn't talk to his mother, and in fact very reluctantly talks about her. So how does a person like that deal with something they don't want to deal with? And, you know, sometimes it's by simply sort of ignoring it, or sometimes it's by trying to fit it into some kind of theoretical construct, such as, you know, this idea that each person in his own life plays the hero and only the hero, and is to be sane means to have the ability not to see yourself as a villain. You know, but is that true? But I was happy to leave it ambiguous because I thought that was true to the character of the story and to the character of Julius. I think it would have been false to sort of tie it up neatly, because that's not at all true of his way of being in the world.
So are you saying that the reader is the one who ties that one up, that the ambiguity is something that you invite the reader to solve?
I think I want to have an act of faith in the reader, in the reader's intelligence and the reader's ability to sit with something that is not easy and not even entirely pleasant to deal with, but to say a novel is a... How would you define a novel? A novel is a small, complicated story about the world. And the fact that it's complicated is important because it tries to be a mirror into reality. And everybody does it in a different way. The way I wanted to do it in this book was to highlight the ambiguity of experience and memory. And that, after the experience is finished, that might be a little bit uncomfortable. Like, oh, you know, I wish this had put me on a more even keel. But in a way, it can be a bracing thing to be knocked off center just a little bit, to be plunged into some other world and to have an experience of that world. It's this young, half Nigerian, half German psychiatrist who has these thoughts and these experiences. And to spend a few hours in his company, hopefully that adds something to the life of the reader. And that's basically all I ask for. So it's that ambiguity is both a challenge and maybe an offering to the reader that I hope that the reader can accept in the terms I've offered it.
Tedju Cole. We spoke to him about his novel, Open City. And now we turn to James Kaplan, whose terrific biography of Frank Sinatra, Frank the Voice, turned me from someone totally indifferent to Sinatra into a fan. Reading like fast-paced, hard-boiled fiction, the biography takes the reader on a fascinating journey through the life of one of America's greatest musical talents. It's a personal, cultural, and musical history of Frank Sinatra's life, loves, and times. I've been telling people that this is actually the best biography I've ever read.
Oh, wow.
I know.
No, that's unbelievable. Thank you.
Well, it is because in some ways I feel that the writing, the very style of writing, which is funny, it's eloquent, it's colloquial, it's a real blast to read. It almost seems like the style itself is completely in sync with a character who is its subject.
Yes, that's no accident.
Okay, tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, I struggled for a while beginning this book, as most writers struggle beginning a book, and I had a false start that lasted several months where I didn't have the voice yet. But I had done a piece a couple of years ago for Vanity Fair about the songwriter Jimmy Van Heusen. It was part of my research for this book. And when I did that piece, I sort of quickly and naturally settled into a, I don't mean to make it sound too artificial, but kind of a tough and swinging style that seemed to be consonant with Jimmy Van Heusen himself, who very much lived as he wrote his music. And so when I floundered a little bit with the beginning of Frank, I was speaking to my brother, who is an editor and who has been a great advisor to me, and he said, just write it like that piece. And so that was kind of a revelation to me.
It's terrific. And it's such a pleasure to read. And it's a very long book, 750 pages, and you just go to 1954. And you have a sequel in the works, is that right?
Yeah, yes. It's a 60-year career. It's a gigantic life. It's a life that touches on every aspect of American culture and history in the 20th century. And so my original contract with Doubleday said, Life of Frank Sinatra, 352 pages. And, and after I had done, I did 3 years of research before I set pen to paper, and I knew right away that I had a big white whale by the tail here.
Yeah, you did. Now, this must be in some ways an obsession for you. What got you into this story?
About 10 years ago, I did a profile for The New Yorker of Jerry Lewis. It was a piece that came kind of out of the blue for me. It came through a mutual friend of mine and Jerry Lewis's, Peter Bogdanovich, the movie director and writer. And in the process of doing that profile, I became close to Jerry Lewis. We wound up speaking a lot about Frank Sinatra, to whom Jerry had been close. And Jerry would always speak of him as Frank, to the point where, by kind of, I guess, almost Stockholm syndrome, I began to think of Sinatra as Frank myself. And then I would catch myself and think, well, no, he's not Frank to you. But a couple of years after I did that piece, Jerry Lewis called me out of the blue one afternoon and asked if I would help him with his book. And I knew instantly what he was talking about. He had been working forever on a memoir of his partnership with Dean Martin. I instantly said, yes, of course, I'll help you with your book. And what came out of that was Lewis's memoir, Dean and Me. As we were finishing that up, Jerry invited me to the 2004 Labor Day Telethon, which that year was being held in Los Angeles. And one night while I was out there, I went out to dinner, not with Jerry, but with a bunch of musicians who were working on the show. They have a big band that plays for the telethon. And we went to an Italian restaurant in Santa Monica, and much food and much alcohol was consumed, and it was a delightful occasion. I was just there as a guy, not as a journalist, and very rowdy. And about an hour or two into the dinner, it turned out that every one of these musicians had worked with Sinatra. So I kind of inwardly rubbed my hands, thinking, okay, here comes the gossip about the women and the mob and the fistfights. And instead, every one of these guys spoke in almost hushed tones, tones of awe, about what an absolute musical genius this man had been, this man who couldn't even read a note of music. And I was very moved by this. I was very struck by it. And it was coming time for me to do my next book. It was around the time that a new biography of Sinatra had come out and gotten slammed by the New York Times. And the reviewer said the definitive biography of Frank Sinatra has yet to be written. So being no shrinking violet, I guess, but never having really done a full-scale biography, I had only done two assisted autobiographies, Jerry Lewis's and John McEnroe's, along with dozens upon dozens of magazine profiles, I decided to take this on. I thought it would be interesting to try, not only interesting, but I thought it would be fascinating to try and get the genius onto the page.
You really did. I mean, this book goes over personal history, cultural history. I'm learning so much about the music of that period. And I have to say, I'm not somebody who really, I didn't grow up in a popular culture household.
Mm.
I was, I think, 13, around 13, when the Beatles phenomenon, the Screaming Girls with the Beatles phenomenon happened. I was never part of that. So I didn't really know that much about Frank Sinatra, and I'm totally into him now, thanks to your book, and been listening to his wonderful, wonderful music.
Yeah, I grew up in a household where all kinds of things were listened to, from classical to Broadway, and certainly popular music. But I was enraptured when the Beatles came along. I'm the same age as you, and I was crazy about rock and roll, and continue to be so to this day. But I guess one thing that I have learned over the years, for myself anyway, I'm not going to proselytize, is that divisions in music are illusory, really, and that genius is genius wherever we find it, whether it's, whether it's Maria Callas or Frank Sinatra.
Yeah, and the respect for that genius is so palpable in your book. But let's start at the beginning here. I was surprised to find out, and probably many people would be, well, I knew that Frank Sinatra was born in Hoboken, New Jersey, but I didn't know that he came from a poor, that he did not come from a poor, poor working class background. That just always seemed to be, you know, part of the mystique that he would have. Tell us about his family, where he came from.
Yeah, well, that was a mystique that he worked very hard to promote himself. He was an ex. Exquisitely sensitive genius who in later life said that at the age of 9 he heard the music of the spheres. But there he was, 9 years old, Hoboken, New Jersey, in the mid-1920s. It was a tough town. It was a blue-collar, working-class town, a port town. We've all seen on the waterfront. It was a rough place, and so it wouldn't do to be walking around listening to the music of the spheres. His mother, Dolly Sinatra, was a force of nature. Dolly was a brilliant woman, a fiery woman. She was politically very active. She was a passionate Democrat, passionate suffragist, once chained herself to a fence to protest that women didn't have the vote. She became a ward leader, Democratic ward leader in Hoboken. She made a living for the family with a practice as a midwife and an abortionist, which was very much under the table in those days, but she made a good living at it. She was extremely ambitious for the family, and by force of will moved her little family, the three of them, from tenement in the Italian-American section in Hoboken to a better house and then a better house still. Very upwardly mobile, and by the time Frank was in his early teens, the family lived in a very nice townhouse in Hoboken. They had a grand piano, they had nice furniture. It was a very middle class existence, and Frank was in many ways a pampered only child. At the same time, Dolly, having the fiery temperament she had and a hair trigger temper, Sinatra said in later years he never knew whether she was going to hug him or hit him.
Do you think his relationship with his mother and maybe also with his father had something to do with his success, with his drive for ambition as well?
Absolutely. I think his mother had everything to do with it. As we've seen, Dolly Sinatra was tremendously ambitious herself. He inherited many of her characteristics, her temper, her fiery temperament, her impatience. He was also, I think, diagnostically obsessive-compulsive and diagnostically manic-depressive. He knew from the single digits of his age that he was a genius, and his entire life was devoted to promoting that genius and becoming the greatest singer in the world.
That was James Kaplan talking about his biography of Frank Sinatra. Stay tuned for more of our roundup of the best shows on Writer's Voice in 2011. After the break.
Here's a song.
What you talking about, Tom?
Huh? Well, about Joe Bushkin and the fellow with the $2 million now.
Yeah.
Joe Bushkin wrote this song that we did in 1940, I guess. 1940 with the Pied Pipers and Connie Haynes. And and Joe Stafford. And of course, Tommy knows better the roster of the band. But vocally, that was the group, the Stafford and the Pied Pipers and Connie and myself. We did a song called Oh, Look at Me Now. I don't know whether I remember what it was.
I'm not the guy who cared about loving. I'm not the guy who cared about fortunes and such. I never cared much. Oh, look at me now. He's the lover I never knew. Technique of kissing I never knew. The art of lovemaking and such I never cared much. Oh, look at me now. I'm a new man, better than Casanova at his best. Da 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 dee da da, I forgot it. I'm so proud I'm busting my vest. I'm a lover, so I'm the guy who bought a big jewel. Yes, I'm the guy who finally fell. fell in love and such. I never cared much, but look at me now.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're bringing you excerpts today from some of the best shows on Writer's Voice in 2011. We picked out 10 to list on our website, writersvoice.net, with links to the archived full show episodes. But we're playing excerpts from 5 of them today. Next up is Susan Rosenberg. I'd never heard of her before I received her book in the mail. But she gave us an interview as riveting as her prison memoir, An American Radical, A Political Prisoner in My Own Country. In it, she exposes systematic human rights abuses in the U.S. prison system. But what's even more powerful is her searing account of her own experience of more than 16 years behind bars. Here, Susan Rosenberg reads an excerpt from the book American Radical about the Washington, D.C. jail, where she spent her first months in prison.
One night, after many days of overcrowding and out-of-control tempers, there was a shakedown. We heard the correctional officers, COs, all 20 of them, marching down the hall leading to the block. Of all the conditions in the jail, the shakedowns were the most invasive, the most enraging, and the most irrational. Of course there were drugs. Dope hit the unit every week. Of course people made weapons. Of course there was contraband food from the kitchen. We watched the cops sell dope, and a weapon could be fashioned from an aluminum can from the commissary. The COs would come suited up in combat gear. Each cell was hit one by one, and mine was always first. Having heard them well in advance of their actual arrival, I had already flushed my contraband coffee grinds, my big illegal item. "Step out," they ordered. I was handcuffed and told spread. This meant facing the wall and stretching out my arms and legs. I was patted down and told to stand next to the door. 4 of them went in. They searched every single thing. They unscrewed the light bulb. They climbed on the top bunk and looked at the windowsill. And they went through every legal and personal paper one by one. They dragged the mattress onto the tier. They took shampoo and talcum powder and poured them out onto the mattress. They took scooped peanut butter from an old jar and smeared it on my personal photographs. They uncuffed me, put me back inside, shut the door, and repeated the process in every cell down the line. Everyone was yelling. In the cells that hadn't been hit yet, women were standing and watching. The violence seemed to increase with each cell. And then they got to the last 3 cells. They popped open the door and one of them roared, "Step out!" The woman inside was brushing her teeth. One of them stepped in and grabbed her. She spit out her mouthful of toothpaste and saliva on him. If they had waited 10 seconds, she would have stepped out on her own. But she was disobeying an order. So 4 of them began to beat her up, with all the rest of us watching. The small woman fought back. Everyone was hollering and throwing things out of their windows. An egg went flying and hit one of the guards. 4 of them dragged the woman up the stairs and into the entrance to the block. The cops had bloodlust in their eyes. In the hall, they couldn't get the cuffs onto her. Her fury matched theirs. Eventually, they overpowered her and carried her off. I had never before seen that level of brutality directed against a woman. We were all crying from anger, frustration, and fear, and yet in the D.C. jail, it was almost normal. It was not extreme, a little more brutal than usual, but only a little. To administer by fear and control, by terror, was a tactic that was understood by the prisoners. It was a natural way of life, inside or outside, and I cried because I didn't know how to resist that level of dehumanization. Amid the wreckage of my cell, I spotted a book of poetry on the floor. I found the well-known poem by Langston Hughes, Harlem, the one that begins, "What happens to a dream deferred?" I stood at my window, and in the pulsating silence in the aftermath of what we had just been through, I read it at the top of my lungs. No one said anything. And then a single voice started singing Amazing Grace, and then another and another, until there were many voices. Everyone knew the words. It was a most beautiful rendition, the richest I had ever heard. And as the sound rose and fell, I remembered hearing somewhere that that song had been written by a slaver, a ship captain who experienced a dramatic conversion and later spoke out strongly against slavery. I once was lost, but now am found.
Thank you so much. I mean, that's such a powerful passage, and it really encapsulates so much of what your book is about. Struggle, resistance, oppression, and poetry, writing. How did you find yourself in the Washington jail?
Well, I was part of the radical student movement in the late 1960s and 70s. I was part of the group of people that was militantly against the war in Vietnam and ended up on a path, a radical path that took me into joining an illegal armed organization in the 1970s and early 1980s, and ended up being arrested with explosives in 1984 and being sentenced to 58 years in federal prison. And I ended up being in a number of prisons over the course of my time, but part of that time was in pretrial detention in the District of Columbia jail, which was a very different kind of jail and prison experience than most of the time that I did, which was in the federal system and under very severe, extreme conditions of maximum security and isolation.
You were arrested because you had explosives. Was anybody hurt during the commission of your crime?
Well, my crime was possession of weapons and explosives and false ID. That was my conviction. And no, nobody was hurt.
So in your book, American Radical, you point out that the longest previous sentence for possession of explosives, previous to your own sentencing, was a maximum of 5 years. You were sentenced to 58. Why this discrepancy?
I think the discrepancy was because of the politics of who we were and what we believed. And I think that the sentence length was really to teach a lesson to people.
Now, this is not an isolated case, this extremely long sentence. It seems that that's the norm, not only then, but even now. I think a lot of people might be surprised to learn that there are political prisoners in the United States. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, what's this all about?
Yeah, the title of my book is A Political Prisoner in My Own Country, and I think that there are political prisoners in the United States, and there are over 100 political prisoners who are from the period of the 60s and 70s and 80s, and now there is, as you mentioned, a new wave of political repression going on against animal rights activists and environmental rights activists, and most, I think, significantly in terms of the politics of the moment are Muslim folk who are being labeled terrorists and sent into maximum security prisons in the U.S. and in detention. And so I think, though, that there's this country is, says that we are the greatest country with democratic and human rights. And so it's very important for the United States to deny that there was political opposition and that there was a political and radical movement and that there was a political police, that the state actually waged a war against the radical movement in this country in the 60s.
Now, I have to ask this. If you were carrying explosives, one would assume you intended at some point to use them. So could you give us a little bit more of that context?
What we believed, my colleagues and comrades and people I was associated with, believed that we needed to physically stop the war machine, that we had to take responsibility as Americans to prevent our government from acting in ways that it was. And so for us, that meant bombing buildings that were part of the government, that were government buildings or military institutions or targets. And I think corporate and industrial, the military-industrial complex. And we thought at the time, and I think we were wrong in many ways, but we thought at the time that in order to build a revolutionary movement, we had to have the capacity to organize people away, separate from the public eye, in order to be effective. And we hoped that if we did some of these kind of actions, it would spark activism. And we, I think, were doing this and thinking this in a period where that was absolutely not going to happen. And that became really obvious. But I certainly feel I read the conditions in the country completely through my own very committed and very rigid eyes.
Mm-hmm. And you were about 25 years old.
I was 28.
Susan Rosenberg. Her book is An American Radical, A Political Prisoner in My Own Country.
On voit danser le long des golfes clairs à des reflets d'argent, la mer, des reflets changeants.
And now, for our final segment of excerpts from five of the 10 best Writer's Voice shows of 2011. Marine ecologist Carl Safina actually wrote two books this year, and we interviewed him about both. One was about the Deepwater Horizon blowout, called A Sea in Flames. But before that, he published his beautiful and widely acclaimed book, The View from Lazy Point, A Natural Year in an Unnatural World. Lazy Point is a flat peninsula of scrubby pines, as the author calls it, in Amagansett, New York. It's Carl Safina's vantage point on the world's oceans, oceans that are in deep trouble from multiple assaults. In The View from Lazy Point, Safina alternates between two poles, lyrical descriptions of the beauty of place, interwoven with strong warnings about the impact of climate change and environmental abuse. He also has some inspiring success stories.
You have a wonderful quote by E.B. White, starting the book. I arise in the morning torn between a desire to save the world and a desire to savor the world. And that seems very much to inform the way you've written the book. You alternate between writing about the grave dangers, the threats that face our world, as well as celebrating the beauty that still remains.
Yes, I've known about that quote for a long time, and I was a little reluctant to actually use it because it sums up my life a little too closely. But it's true, and it's one of the main motivations I had for writing the book, is that if you are in the environmental world, as I am, it seems like all you ever get is a lot of gloom and doom and a lot of terrible news. But if you're a naturalist and you look around and you know, just think about trends, you realize that, first of all, the world is still absolutely a beautiful place. And secondly, there are really dangerous trends, but there's a lot to inform us about other dangerous trends that we have lived through. Times have been very bad before. The future is not really knowable. And so I really reject the idea of just throwing up our hands and say the world is over, because we really don't know. But I do think that the trends now are very dangerous. There is a lot at stake, and I think everybody really should not hide from that either.
You say that, you know, it's possible to see the whole world in the view from Lazy Point. What are some of the changes that you've seen there that kind of bring this home to you?
Well, I think if you have your eyes open, you can see the whole world from anywhere. But what I've seen out at Lazy Point and in my life around Long Island, because I grew, to the extent that I have grown up, I grew up around Long Island, and you know, I have some perspective. You know, it's just as far as nature itself, there's less of it. Some of the bird populations are down a lot. Many of the fish populations are down a lot. If you also look, you see some fish populations are up because of things that people have done. Some birds are back, especially the ones that were the most vulnerable, like ospreys and peregrine falcons that were just about wiped off the face of the earth by DDT and the other hard pesticides. Those returned after those pesticides were banned. So there's a tremendous resilience that you can see at work as well. And that is a tremendous reservoir of hope, because if we recognize what we're doing and back off or do the right things or change our course, then I think that we can recover a lot of these things that we are losing.
One place where there's both good and bad news is with corals. We could lose 50% of coral reefs this century, yet there's also reason to hope.
There are probably no places that are not in some peril, but there are success stories around in various ways. In the case of the coral reefs that I visited in Palau and in Micronesia, the success there is that they had the wisdom, also partly because their population was low enough, they were able to do this, but they had the wisdom to prevent the export of fish from their reefs. And most people think that reef fish rely on coral reefs for their living, which is true. But another part that is also true is that the reefs rely on the fish themselves to stay alive, that the fish are constantly grazing the algae that's always trying to overgrow all the coral. And if you fish the fish down too low, the algae gets out of control. Once that happens, the coral dies and cannot reestablish itself. And it just goes from a coral reef to a rubble field full of seaweed, a very, very different thing that is a lot less productive.
Yeah, and here was a place where the reefs had actually died about 10 years ago because of climate change, but they were able to bring them back. Give us the ecology of this recovery.
Well, in Palau, about 10 years ago, there was a tremendous heat spike, as there was around many of the tropical places in the world, and a lot of coral died, and a lot of coral died permanently. But in Palau, it died temporarily and was able to come back. And the reason was that the reefs are swarming with these fish that they don't allow to be exported, and the fish continued to just keep the algae grazed so low, you can't even see it. Scientists have watched how many times fish come by and just bite at each square meter of the reef, each square yard of the reef, and it's like 100 bites an hour in a lot of places. So they're scraping off these little micro layers of algae that are barely getting a foothold. People can't even see the algae. And that's why those reefs were able to reestablish, because they had their fish. And as I said, it's not just that the fish rely on the corals rely on the fish as well.
Carl Safina tells a powerful story in The View from Lazy Point about the day he and his partner went looking for horseshoe crabs. Those ancient creatures used to be a common sight on the beaches of Long Island's East End, but they've been over-harvested, and they're now rare.
I was taking a walk in the moonlight along the shore, and I just happened to, it was a full moon. That's one of the reasons that I was out walking. And I just happened onto the spawning of the horseshoe crabs. I was new to the place, so I didn't realize that they spawned along that shore. And what they do in May and June in the full moons, they come up and lay their eggs at the highest reach of the highest tides. And then the next full moon stimulates the eggs to hatch, and the little tiny hatchlings go into the water. So I was enchanted by the scene of all these horseshoe crabs coming up and mating and digging nests and laying eggs in the moonlight. And I called my partner, Patricia. She came out, and we were delighting in the whole scene. And then a pair of headlights came bouncing up the beach, and it was a pickup truck with a fisherman, and we could suddenly hear the thudding of many horseshoe crabs going into the truck. It's the ones with the eggs that are the best bait. So he was trying to take every female who was there to lay eggs and throw them in the truck. Now, I don't have as much of an appetite for direct confrontation, but Pat simply decided that if he was going to take the horseshoe crabs off the beach, she was going to take the horseshoe crabs off the beach too, but throw them into deep water where he couldn't reach them. And when he realized that she was doing that directly to oppose what his plans were, we had, he and I had a confrontation. She stayed in the water throwing horseshoe crabs into deep water at as fast and furious a pace as she could, because she was really wound into quite an anger about the whole thing. And he was making his case to me that it was all legal. And I said, yes, I know it's legal. And he said, and we have a limit, 500 a night. And I looked, I said, 500 a night? There's not 500 crabs here on the whole beach right now. You just can't do that with a hope of continuing to do it. He said, well, my grandfather used to do it. Well, your grandfather used to take a few for bait. He wasn't shipping them out of state for a dollar a piece like you can do now, because the whole market has changed and the demand has so thoroughly changed. So, you know, we didn't come to blows or anything like that. He was upset. I was upset. She was upset. Then another truck came by, and I thought, well, this really changes the balance of the whole conversation. But they conferred, and they decided to simply leave. And we left, of course, after a while. We came back in the morning. There were lots of trucks, tracks all over the beach. They obviously had come back. And when I went back the next month, instead of finding hundreds, I found six.
Horseshoe crabs.
Six horseshoe crabs, yeah.
Carl Safina. We spoke to him about his book, The View from Lazy Point. You can hear the full interview by going to writersvoice.net. So those were five of our top 10 shows of 2011. Here are the other five we didn't get to hear excerpts from. Elizabeth Tova Bailey told us about The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating. It's her memoir of a year spent closely observing a snail by her bedside while she lay bedridden during a severe illness. Then T.J. English told us about his nonfiction thriller, The Savage City. It's about a decade of violence, corruption, and revolt in New York City from the early 1960s to the 70s. Then we had Jeff Charlotte on, again. He's one of my favorite authors, and we've had him on the show more than a few times. Charlotte's latest book is a collection of essays about faith and faithlessness in America and the country in between. It's called Sweet Heaven When I Die. And finally, one of our most controversial shows this year was our interview with cartoonist Ted Rall about his revolutionary call to arms, the Anti-American Manifesto. It's thought-provoking, and in the light of Occupy Wall Street, which erupted long after our interview, his book was quite prescient. You can find links to all of these episodes at writersvoice.net. May your new year be a good one. We look forward to bringing you lots of great new interviews here on Writer's Voice in 2012. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.